those. The recruits began practicing their spear work as Bennis bellowed at them. Stick and twist and rip it free! Stick and twist and rip! But get the damned thing out! You'll be wanting it soon enough for the next one. Too slow, Treb, too damned slow. If you can't do it quicker, go back to chucking rocks. Lem, get your weight behind your thrust. There's a boy. And in and out, fuck 'em with it, that's the way. In and out, rip 'em, rip 'em, rip 'em! When the sacks had been torn to pieces by 6,000 spear thrusts, and all the straw spilled out onto the ground, Dunk donned his mail and plate and took up a wooden sword to see how the men would fare against a livelier foe. Not too well, was the answer. Only Treb was quick enough to get a spear past Dunk's shield, and he only did it once. Dunk turned one clumsy, lurching thrust after another, pushed their spears aside, and bulled in close. If his sword had been steel instead of pine, he would have slain each of them 6 times. You're dead once I get past your point, he warned them, hammering at their legs and arms to drive the lesson home. Treb and Lem and Wet Watt soon learned how to give ground, at least. Big Rob dropped his spear and ran, and Bennis had to chase him down and drag him back in tears. The end of the afternoon saw the lot of them all bruised and battered, with fresh blisters rising on their calloused hands from where they gripped the spears. Dunk bore no marks himself, but he was half drowned by sweat by the time Egg helped him peel his armor off. As the sun was going down, Dunk marched their little company down into the cellar and forced them all to have a bath, even those who'd had one just last winter. Afterward, Sam Stoop's wife had bowls of stew for all, thick with carrots, onions, and barley. The men were bone-tired, but to hear them talk, every one would soon be twice as deadly as a Kingsguard knight. They could hardly wait to prove their valour. Sir Bennis egged them on by telling them of the joys of the soldier's life, loot and women, chiefly. The two old hands agreed with him. Lem had brought back a knife and a pair of fine boots from the Blackfyre Rebellion, to hear him tell. The boots were too small for him to wear, but he had them hanging on his wall. And Pate could not say enough about some of the camp followers he'd known following the dragon. Sam Stoops had set them up with 8 straw pallets in the undercroft, so once their bellies were filled, they all went off to sleep. Bennis lingered long enough to give Dunk a look of disgust. Sir Useless should have fucked a few more peasant wenches while he still had a bit of sap left in them old sad balls of his, he said. If he'd sown himself a nice crop of bastard boys back then, might be we'd have some soldiers now. They seem no worse than any other peasant levy. Dunk had marched with a few such while squiring for Sir Arlan. Aye, Sir Bennis said. In a fortnight they might stand their own against some other lot of peasants. Knights, though? He shook his head and spat. Standfast's well was in the undercellar, in a dank chamber walled in stone and earth. It was there that Sam Stoop's wife soaked and scrubbed and beat the clothes before carrying them up to the roof to dry. The big stone washtub was also used for baths. Bathing required drawing water from the well bucket by bucket, heating it over the hearth in a big iron kettle, emptying the kettle into the tub, then starting the whole process once again. It took 4 buckets to fill the kettle and 3 kettles to fill the tub. By the time the last kettle was hot, the water from the first had cooled to lukewarm. Sir Bennis had been heard to say that the whole thing was too much bloody bother, which was why he crawled with lice and fleas, and smelled like a bad cheese. Dunk at least had Egg to help him when he felt in dire need of a good wash, as he did tonight. The lad drew the water in a glum silence and hardly spoke as it was heating. Egg? Dunk asked as the last kettle was coming to a boil. Is aught amiss? When Egg made no reply, he said, Help me with the kettle. Together they wrestled it from hearth to tub, taking care not to splash themselves. Sir, the boy said. What do you think Sir Eustace means to do? Tear down the dam and fight off the widow's men if they try to stop us. He spoke loudly, so as to be heard above the splashing of the bathwater. Steam rose in a white curtain as they poured, bringing a flush to his face. Their shields are woven wood, sir. A lance could punch right through them, or a crossbow bolt. We may find some bits of armor for them when they're ready. That was the best they could hope for. They might be killed, sir. Wet Watt is still half a boy. Will Barleycorn is to be married the next time the Septon comes, and Big Rob doesn't even know his left foot from his right. Dunk let the empty kettle thump down onto the hard-packed earthen floor. Roger of Pennytree was younger than Wet Wat when he died on the Red Grass Field. There were men in your father's host who'd been just married too, and other men who'd never even kissed a girl. There were hundreds who didn't know their left foot from their right, maybe thousands. That was different, Egg insisted. That was war. So was this. The same thing, only smaller. Smaller and stupider, sir. That's not for you or me to say, Dunk told him. It's their duty to go to war when Sir Eustace summons them, and to die, if need be.
Then we shouldn't have named them, sir. It will only make the grief harder for us when they die. He screwed up his face. If we used my boot...
No. Dunk stood on one leg to pull his own boot off.
Yes, but my father...
No. The second boot went the way of the first. We... No. Dunk pulled his sweat-stained tunic up over his head and tossed it at Egg. Ask Sam Stoop's wife to wash that for me.
I will, sir, but...
No, I said. Do you need a clout in the ear to help you hear better? He unlaced his breeches. Underneath was only him. It was too hot for small clothes. It's good that you're concerned for Wat and Wat and Wat and the rest of them. But the boot is only meant for dire need. How many eyes does Lord Bloodraven have? 1,000 eyes and 1. What did your father tell you when he sent you off to squire for me?
To keep my hair shaved or dyed? And tell no man my true name, the boy said, with obvious reluctance.
Egg had served Dunk for a good year and a half, though some days it seemed like 20. They had climbed the Prince's Pass together and crossed the deep sands of Dawn, both red and white. A pole boat had taken them down the Green Blood to the Planky Town, where they took passage for Old Town on the galleass White Lady. They had slept in stables, inns and ditches, broken bread with holy brothers, whores and mummers, and chased down 100 puppet shows. Egg had kept Dunk's horse groomed, his longsword sharp, his mail free of rust. He had been as good a companion as any man could wish for, and the hedge knight had come to think of him almost as a little brother. He isn't, though. This Egg had been hatched of dragons, not of chickens. Egg might be a hedge knight squire, but Aegon of House Targaryen was the 4th and youngest son of Maekar, Prince of Summerhall, himself the 4th son of the late King Daeron the Good, the 2nd of his name, who'd sat the Iron Throne for 25 years until the great spring sickness took him off. So far as most folk are concerned, Aegon Targaryen went back to Summerhall with his brother Daeron after the tourney at Ashford Meadow, Dunk reminded the boy. Your father did not want it known that you were wandering the 7 kingdoms with some hedge knight. So let's hear no more about your boot. A look was all the answer that he got. Egg had big eyes, and somehow his shaven head made them look even larger. In the dimness of the lamplit cellar they looked black, but in better light their true colour could be seen, deep and dark and purple. Valyrian eyes, thought Dunk. In Westeros, few but the blood of the dragon had eyes that colour, or hair that shone like beaten gold and strands of silver woven all together. When they'd been poling down the Green Blood, the orphan girls had made a game of rubbing Egg's shaven head for luck. It made the boy blush redder than a pomegranate. Girls are so stupid, he would say. The next one who touches me is going into the river. Dunk had to tell him, then I'll be touching you. I'll give you such a clout in the ear, you'll be hearing bells for a moon's turn. That only goaded the boy to further insolence. Better bells than stupid girls, he insisted, but he never threw anyone into the river. Dunk stepped into the tub and eased himself down until the water covered him up to his chin. It was still scalding hot on top, though cooler farther down. He clenched his teeth to keep from yelping. If he did, the boy would laugh. Egg liked his bath water scalding hot.
Do you need more water boiled, sir?
This will serve. Dunk rubbed at his arms and watched the dirt come off in long grey clouds.
Fetch me the soap. Oh, and the long-handled scrub brush, too.
Thinking about Egg's hair had made him remember that his own was filthy. He took a deep breath and slid down beneath the water to give it a good soak. When he emerged again, sloshing, Egg was standing beside the tub with the soap and long-handled horsehair brush in hand.
You have hairs on your cheek, Dunk observed as he took the soap from him. 2 of them. There, below your ear. Make sure you get them the next time you shave your head.
I will, sir.
The boy seemed pleased by the discovery. No doubt he thinks a bit of beard makes him a man.
Dunk had thought the same when he first found some fuzz growing on his upper lip. I tried to shave with my dagger and almost nicked my nose off.
"Go and get some sleep now," he told Egg. "I won't have any more need of you till morning."
It took a long while to scrub all the dirt and sweat away. Afterward, he put the soap aside, stretched out as much as he was able, and closed his eyes. The water had cooled by then. After the savage heat of the day, it was a welcome relief. He soaked till his feet and fingers were all wrinkled up and the water had gone grey and cold, and only then reluctantly climbed out. Though he and Egg had been given thick straw pallets down in the cellar, Dunk preferred to sleep up on the roof. The air was fresher there, and sometimes there was a breeze. It was not as though he need have much fear of rain. The next time it rained on them up there would be the first. Egg was asleep by the time Dunk reached the roof. He lay on his back with his hands behind his head and stared up at the sky. The stars were everywhere, thousands and thousands of them. It reminded him of a night at Ashford Meadow before the tournée started. He had seen a falling star that night. Falling stars were supposed to bring you luck, so he told Tansel to paint it on his shield, but Ashford had been anything but lucky for him. Before the tourney ended, he had almost lost a hand and a foot, and three good men had lost their lives. I gained a squire, though. Egg was with me when I rode away from Ashford. That was the only good thing to come of all that happened. He hoped that no stars fell tonight.
Aria. The sky was as black as the walls of Harrenhal behind them, and the rain fell soft and steady, muffling the sound of their horses' hooves and running down their faces. They rode north, away from the lake, following a rutted farm road across the torn fields and into the woods and streams. Arya took the lead, kicking her stolen horse to a brisk, heedless trot until the trees closed in around her. Hot Pie and Gendry followed as best they could. Wolves howled in the distance, and she could hear Hot Pie's heavy breathing. No one spoke. From time to time, Arya glanced over her shoulder to make sure the two boys had not fallen too far behind, and to see if they were being pursued. They would be, she knew. She had stolen three horses from the stables and a map and a dagger from Roose Bolton's own solar, and killed a guard on the postern gate, slitting his throat when he knelt to pick up the worn iron coin that Jake and Hagar had given her. Someone would find him lying dead in his own blood, and then the hue and cry would go up. They would wake Lord Bolton and search Harrenhal from crennel to cellar, and when they did they would find the map and the dagger missing, along with some swords from the armory, bread and cheese from the kitchens, a baker boy, apprentice smith, and a cupbearer called Nan, or Weasel, or Arry, depending on who you asked. The Lord of the Dreadfort would not come after them himself. Roose Bolton would stay abed, his pasty flesh dotted with leeches, giving commands in his whispery, soft voice. His man Walton might lead the hunt, the one they call Steelshanks, for the greaves he always wore on his long legs. Or perhaps it would be slobbery Vargo Holt and his sellswords, who named themselves the Brave Companions. Others called them Bloody Mummers, though never to their faces, and sometimes the Footmen, for Lord Vargo's habit of cutting off the hands and feet of men who displeased him.
"If they catch us, he'll cut off our hands and feet," Arya thought, "and then Roose Bolton will peel the skin off us."
She was still dressed in her page's garb, and on the breast over her heart was sewn Lord Bolton's sigil, the flayed man of the Dreadfort. Every time she looked back, she half expected to see a blaze of torches pouring out of the distant gates of Harrenhal or rushing along the tops of its huge high walls. But there was nothing. Harrenhal slept on, until it was lost in darkness and hidden behind the trees. When they crossed the first stream, Arya turned her horse aside and led them off the road, following the twisting course of the water for a quarter mile, before finally scrambling out and up a stony bank. If the hunters brought dogs, that might throw them off the scent, she hoped. They could not stay on the road.
"There is death on the road," she told herself. "Death on all the roads." Gendry and Hot Pie did not question her choice. She had the map after all, and Hot Pie seemed almost as terrified of her as of the men who might be coming after them. He had seen the guard she'd killed. "It's better if he's scared of me," she told herself. "That way he'll do like I say instead of something stupid." She should be more frightened herself, she knew. She was only 10, a skinny girl on a stolen horse, with a dark forest ahead of her, and men behind who had gladly cut off her feet. Yet somehow she felt calmer than she ever had in Harrenhal. The rain had washed the guard's blood off her fingers. She wore a sword across her back. Wolves were prowling through the dark, like lean grey shadows, and Arya Stark was unafraid. "Fear cuts deeper than swords," she whispered under her breath, the words that Cyrio Forel had taught her, and Jaqen's words too, Velar Morghulis. The rain stopped and started again, and stopped once more and started, but they had good cloaks to keep the water off. Arya kept them moving, at a slow, steady pace. It was too black beneath the trees to ride any faster. The boys were no horsemen, neither one, and the soft broken ground was treacherous with half-buried roots and hidden stones. They crossed another road, its deep ruts filled with runoff, but Arya shunned it. Up and down the rolling hills she took them, through brambles and briars and tangles of underbrush, along the bottoms of narrow gullies where branches heavy with wet leaves slapped at their faces as they passed. Gendry's mare lost her footing in the mud once, going down hard on her hindquarters and spilling him from the saddle, but neither horse nor rider was hurt, and Gendry got that stubborn look on his face and mounted right up again. Not long after, they came upon three wolves devouring the corpse of a fawn. When Hot Pie's horse caught the scent, he shied and bolted. Two of the wolves fled as well, but the third raised his head and bared his teeth, prepared to defend his kill. "Back off," Arya told Gendry. "Slow, so you don't spook him." They edged their mounts away until the wolf and his feast were no longer in sight. Only then did she swing about to ride after Hot Pie, who was clinging desperately to the saddle as he crashed through the trees. Later they passed through a burned village, threading their way carefully between the shells of blackened hovels and past the bones of a dozen dead men hanging from a row of apple trees. When Hot Pie saw them, he began to pray, a thin, whispered plea for the mother's mercy, repeated over and over. Arya looked up at the fleshless dead in their wet, rotting clothes and said her own prayer. "Sir Gregor," it went, "Dunson, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling, the Tickler and the Hound, Sir Ilion, Sir Merrin, King Joffrey, Queen Cersei." She ended it with Velar Morghulis, touched Jaqen's coin where it nestled on her belt, and then reached up and plucked an apple from among the dead men as she rode beneath them. It was mushy and overripe, but she ate it, worms and all. That was the day without a dawn. Slowly the sky lightened around them, but they never saw the sun. Black turned to grey, and colours crept timidly back into the world. The soldier pines were dressed in sombre greens, the broad leaves in russets and faded golds, already beginning to brown. They stopped long enough to water the horses and eat a cold, quick breakfast, ripping apart a loaf of bread that Hot Pie had stolen from the kitchens, and passing chunks of hard yellow cheese from hand to hand.
"Do you know where we're going?" Gendry asked her.
"North," said Arya. Hot Pie peered around uncertainly.
"Which way is north?"
She used her cheese to point. "That way."
"But there's no sun. How do you know?"
"From the moss. See how it grows mostly on one side of the trees? That's south."
"What do we want in the north?" Gendry wanted to know.
"The trident." Arya unrolled the stolen map to show them. "See, once we reach the trident, all we need to do is follow it upstream till we come to River Run. Here." Her finger traced the path. "It's a long way,
but we can't get lost so long as we keep to the river.
Hot Pie blinked at the map. Which one is River Run?
River Run was painted as a castle tower in the fort between the flowing blue lines of two rivers, the Tumblestone and the Red Fork.
There, she touched it. River Run, it reads.
You can read writing, he said to her, wonderingly, as if she said she could walk on water.
She nodded. We'll be safe once we reach River Run.
We will. Why?
Because River Run is my grandfather's castle, and my brother Rob will be there, she wanted to say. She bit her lip and rolled up the map.
We just will, but only if we get there.
She was the first one back in the saddle. It made her feel bad to hide the truth from Hot Pie, but she did not trust him with her secret. Gendry knew, but that was different. Gendry had his own secret, though even he didn't seem to know what it was. That day Arya quickened their pace, keeping the horses to a trot as long as she dared, and sometimes spurring to a gallop when she spied a flat stretch of field before them. That was seldom enough, though. The ground was growing hillier as they went. The hills were not high nor especially steep, but there seemed to be no end of them, and they soon grew tired of climbing up one and down the other and found themselves following the lay of the land, along stream beds, and through a maze of shallow wooded valleys where the trees made a solid canopy overhead. From time to time she sent Hot Pie and Gentry on while she doubled back to try to confuse their trail, listening all the while for the first sign of pursuit.
Too slow, she thought to herself, chewing her lip. We're going too slow. They'll catch us for certain.
Once from the crest of a ridge, she spied dark shapes crossing a stream in the valley behind them, and for half a heartbeat she feared that Roos Bolton's riders were on them. But when she looked again, she realized they were only a pack of wolves. She cupped her hands around her mouth and howled down at them.
"Ahoo! Ahoo!"
When the loudest of the wolves lifted its head and howled back, the sound made Arya shiver. By midday, Hot Pie had begun to complain. His arse was sore, he told them, and the saddle was rubbing him raw inside his legs, and besides, he had to get some sleep.
"I'm so tired, I'm going to fall off the horse."
Arya looked at Gendry.
"If he falls off, who do you think will find him first, the wolves or the mummers?" "Oh, the wolves," said Gentry. "Better noses."
Hot Pie opened his mouth and closed it. He did not fall off his horse. The rain began a short time later. They still had not seen so much as a glimpse of the sun. It was growing colder, and pale white mists were threading between the pines and blowing across the bare, burned fields. Gendry was having almost as bad a time of it as Hot Pie, although he was too stubborn to complain. He sat awkwardly in the saddle, a determined look on his face beneath his shaggy black hair. But Arya could tell he was no horseman. I should have remembered, she thought to herself. She had been riding as long as she could remember, ponies when she was little, and later horses. But Gendry and Hot Pie were city-born, and in the city small folk walked. Yoren had given them mounts when he took them from King's Landing, but sitting on a donkey and plodding up the King's Road behind a wagon was one thing. Guiding a hunting horse through wild woods and burn fields was something else. She would make much better time on her own, Arya knew, but she could not leave them. They were her pack, her friends, the only living friends that remained to her, and if not for her, they would still be safe at Harrenhal. Gendry sweating at his forge and Hot Pie in his kitchens.
If the mummers catch us, I'll tell them that I'm Ned Stark's daughter and sister to the king in the north. I'll command them to take me to my brother, and to do no harm to Hot Pie and Gendry.
They might not believe her, though, and even if they did, Lord Bolton was her brother's bannerman, but he frightened her all the same.
I won't let them take us, she vowed silently,
reaching back over her shoulder to touch the hilt of the sword that Gendry had stolen for her.
I won't. Late that afternoon, they emerged from beneath the trees and found themselves on the banks of a river. Hot Pie gave a whoop of delight.
"The Trident! Now all we have to do is go upstream like you said. We're almost there."
Arya chewed her lip. "I don't think this is the Trident. The river was swollen by the rain, but even so, it couldn't be much more than 30 feet across." She remembered the Trident as being much wider.
"It's too little to be the Trident," she told them, "and we didn't come far enough."
"Yes, we did," Hot Pie insisted. "We rode all day and hardly stopped at all. We must have come a long way."
"Let's have a look at that map again," said Gendry.
Arya dismounted, took out the map, unrolled it. The rain pattered against the sheepskin and ran off in rivulets.
"We're someplace here, I think," she said, pointing, as the boys peered over her shoulders.
"But," said Hot Pie, "that's hardly any ways at all. See, Harrenhal's there by your finger. You're almost touching it. And we rode all day."
"There's miles and miles before we reach the Trident," she said. "We won't be there for days. This must be some different river. One of these, see?"
She showed them some of the thinner blue lines the mapmaker had painted in, each with a name painted in fine script beneath it.
"The Derry, the Green Apple, the Maiden, here, this one, the Little Willow, it might be that."
Hot Pie looked from the line to the river.
"It doesn't look so little to me."
Gendry was frowning as well.
"The one you're pointing at runs into that other one, see?"
"The Big Willow," she read.
"The Big Willow, then, see? And the Big Willow runs into the Trident. So we could follow the one to the other. But we need to go downstream, not up. Only if this river isn't the Little Willow, if it's this other one here..."
"Ripple down rill," Arya read.
"See, it loops around and flows down toward the lake, back to Harrenhal."
He traced the line with a finger. Hot Pie's eyes grew wide.
"No, they'll kill us for sure." "We have to know which river this is," declared Gendry, in his stubbornest voice. "We have to know."
"Well, we don't." The map might have names written beside the blue lines, but no one had written a name on the riverbank. "We won't go up or downstream," she decided, rolling up the map. "We'll cross and keep going north, like we were."
"Can horses swim?" asked Hot Pie. "It looks deep, Harry. What if there are snakes?" "Are you sure we're going north?" asked Gendry. "All these hills, if we got turned around, the moss on the trees." He pointed to a nearby tree. "That tree's got moss on three sides, and the next one has no moss at all. We could be lost just riding around in a circle."
"We could be," said Arya, "but I'm going to cross the river anyway. Now you can come, or you can stay here." She climbed back into the saddle, ignoring the both of them. If they didn't want to follow, they could find river on their own, though more likely the mummers would just find them. She had to ride a good half mile along the bank before she finally found a place where it looked as though it might be safe to cross, and even then her mare was reluctant to enter the water. The river, whatever its name, was running brown and fast, and the deep part in the middle came up past the horse's belly. Water filled her boots, but she pressed her heels in all the same and climbed out on the far bank. From behind she heard splashing and a mare's nervous whinny. They followed then. Good. She turned to watch as the boy struggled across and emerged dripping beside her.
"It wasn't a Trident," she told them. "It wasn't."
The next river was shallower and easier to ford. That one wasn't the Trident either, and no one argued with her when she told them they would cross it. Dusk was settling as they stopped to rest the horses once more and share another meal of bread and cheese.
"I'm cold and wet," Hot Pie complained. "We're a long way from Harrenhal now, for sure. We could have us a fire."
"No," Arya and Gendry both said at the exact same instant.
Hot Pie quailed a little. Arya gave Gendry a sideways look.
He said it with me, like John used to do, back in Winterfell.
She missed Jon Snow the most of all her brothers.
Could we sleep, at least? Hot Pie asked. I'm so tired, Arya, and my arse is sore. I think I've got blisters.
You'll have more than that if you're caught, she said.
We've got to keep going, we've got to. But it's almost dark, and you can't even see the moon. Get back on your horse.
Plodding along at a slow walking pace as the light faded around them, Arya found her own exhaustion weighing heavy on her. She needed sleep as much as Hot Pie, but they dare not. If they slept, they might open their eyes to find Vargo Hoat standing over them, with Shagwell the Fool, and faithful Urswick, and Rorg, and Biter, and Septon Ut, and all his other monsters. Yet after a while, the motion of her horse became as soothing as the rocking of a cradle, and Arya found her eyes growing heavy. She let them close just for an instant, then snapped them wide again.
I can't go to sleep, she screamed at herself silently. I can't, I can't.
She knuckled at her eye and rubbed it hard to keep it open, clutching the reins tightly and kicking her mount to a canter. But neither she nor the horse could sustain the pace, and it was only a few moments before they fell back to a walk again, and a few more until her eyes closed a second time. This time they did not open quite so quickly. When they did, she found that her horse had come to a stop and was nibbling at a tuft of grass, while Gentry was shaking her arm.
You fell asleep, he told her.
I was just resting my eyes.
You were resting them a long while, then. Your horse was wandering in a circle, and it wasn't till he stopped that I realized you were sleeping. Up Pie's just as bad. He rode into a tree limb and got knocked off. You should have heard him yell. Even that didn't wake you up. You need to stop and sleep.
I can keep going as long as you can, she yawned.
Liar, he said. You keep going if you want to be stupid, but I'm stopping. I'll take the first watch. You sleep.
What about Hot Pie? Gendry pointed. Hot Pie was already on the ground, curled up beneath his cloak, on a bed of damp leaves and snoring softly. He had a big wedge of cheese in one fist, but it looked as though he had fallen asleep between bites. It was no good arguing, Arya realized. Gendry had the right of it. The mummers will need to sleep too, she told herself, hoping it was true. She was so weary it was a struggle even to get down from the saddle, but she remembered to hobble a horse before finding a place beneath a beech tree. The ground was hard and damp. She wondered how long it would be before she slept in a bed again with hot food and a fire to warm her. The last thing she did before closing her eyes was unsheathe her sword and lay it down beside her. Sir Gregor, she whispered, yawning, Dunson, Polliver, Raffus Wheatling, the Tickler, the Tickler, the Hound. Her dreams were red and savage. The mummers were in them, four at least, a pale Lyseni, and a dark, brutal axeman from Ib, the scarred Dothraki horse lord called Iggo, and a Dornishman whose name she never knew. On and on they came, riding through the rain, in rusting mail and wet leather, swords and axe clanking against their saddles. They thought they were hunting her, she knew with all the strange, sharp certainty of dreams, but they were wrong. She was hunting them. She was no little girl in her dream. She was a wolf, huge and powerful, and when she emerged from beneath the trees in front of them and bared her teeth in a low, rumbling growl, she could smell the rank stench of fear from horse and man alike. The Lyseni's mount reared and screamed in terror, and the others shouted at one another in man-talk, but before they could act, the other wolves came hurtling from the darkness and the rain, a great pack of them, gaunt and wet and silent. The fight was short, but bloody. The hairy man went down as he unslung his axe. The dark one died, stringing an arrow, and the pale man from Lys tried to bolt.
Her brothers and sisters ran him down, turning him again and again, coming at him from all sides, snapping at the legs of his horse, and tearing the throat from the rider when he came crashing to the earth. Only the belled man stood his ground. His horse kicked in the head of one of her sisters, and he cut another almost in half with his curved, silvery claw as his hair tinkled softly. Filled with rage, she leapt onto his back, knocking him head first from his saddle. Her jaws locked on his arm as they fell, her teeth sinking through the leather and wool and soft flesh. When they landed, she gave a savage jerk with her head and ripped the limb loose from his shoulder. Exulting, she shook it back and forth in her mouth, scattering the warm red droplets amidst the cold black rain.
Circe. She dreamt she sat the iron throne, high above them all. The courtiers were brightly coloured mice below. Great lords and proud ladies knelt before her. Bold young knights laid their swords at her feet and pleaded for her favours, and the queen smiled down at them. Until the dwarf appeared, as if from nowhere, pointing at her and howling with laughter. The lords and ladies began to chuckle too, hiding their smiles behind their hands. Only then did the queen realize she was naked. Horrified, she tried to cover herself with her hands. The barbs and blades of the iron throne bit into her flesh as she crouched to hide her shame. Blood ran red down her legs, as steel teeth gnawed at her buttocks. When she tried to stand, her foot slipped through a gap in the twisted metal. The more she struggled, the more the throne engulfed her, tearing chunks of flesh from her breasts and belly, slicing at her arms and legs until they were slick and red, glistening. And all the while her brother capered below, laughing. His merriment still echoed in her ears when she felt a light touch on her shoulder and woke suddenly. For half a heartbeat, the hand seemed part of the nightmare, and Circe cried out. But it was only Sinel. The maid's face was white and frightened. We are not alone, the queen realized. Shadows loomed around her bed, tall shapes with chainmail glimmering beneath their cloaks. Armed men had no business here. Where are my guards? Her bedchamber was dark, but for the lantern one of the intruders held on high, I must show no fear. Circe pushed back sleep-tousled hair and said, What do you want of me? A man stepped into the lantern light, and she saw his cloak was white. Jamie? I dreamt of one brother, but the other has come to wake me. Your Grace, the voice was not her brother's. The Lord Commander said come get you. His hair curled as Jamie's did, but her brother's hair was beaten gold like hers, where this man's was black and oily. She stared at him, confused, as he muttered about a privy and a crossbow, and said her father's name. I am dreaming still, Circe thought. I have not woken, nor has my nightmare ended. Tyrion will creep out from under the bed soon and begin to laugh at me. But that was folly. Her dwarf brother was down in the black cells, condemned to die this very day. She looked down at her hands, turning them over to make certain all her fingers were still there. When she ran a hand down her arm, the skin was covered with goose prickles, but unbroken. There were no cuts on her legs, no gashes on the soles of her feet. A dream. That's all it was, a dream. I drank too much last night. These fears are only humours born of wine. I will be the one laughing come dusk. My children will be safe, Tommen's throne will be secure, and my twisted little Valonqar will be short ahead and rotting. Jocelyn Swift was at her elbow, pressing a cup on her. Circe took a sip, water mixed with lemon squeezings, so tart she spit it out. She could hear the night wind rattling the shutters, and she saw, with a strange, sharp clarity, Jocelyn was trembling like a leaf, as frightened as Sinel. Sir Osmond Kettleblack loomed over her. Behind him stood Sir Boros Blount with a lantern. At the door were Lannister guardsmen with gilded lions shining on the crests of their helmets. They looked afraid as well. Can it be? The queen wondered. Can it be true? She rose and let Sinel slip a bedrobe over her shoulders to hide her nakedness. Circe belted it herself, her fingers stiff and clumsy. "My lord father keeps guards about him night and day," she said. Her tongue felt thick. She took another swallow of lemon water and sloshed it round her mouth to freshen her breath. A moth had gotten into the lantern Sir Boros was holding. She could hear it buzzing and see the shadow of its wings as it beat against the glass. "The guards were at their posts, Your Grace," said Osmond Kettleblack. "We found a hidden door behind the hearth, a secret passage. The Lord Commander's gone down to see where it goes." "Jamie!" Terror seized her, sudden as a storm. "Jamie should be with the king!" "The lad's not been harmed. Sir Jamie sent a dozen men to look in on him. His Grace is sleeping peaceful. Let him have a sweeter dream than mine, and a kinder waking. Who is with the king?" "Sir Loras has that honour, if it please you." It did not please her. The Tyrells were only stewards that the Dragon Kings had upjumped far above their station. Their vanity was exceeded only by their ambition. Sir Loras might be as pretty as a maiden's dream, but underneath his white cloak he was Tyrell to the bone. For all she knew, this night's foul fruit had been planted and nurtured in High Garden. But that was a suspicion she dare not speak aloud. "Allow me a moment to dress. Sir Osmond, you shall accompany me to the Tower of the Hand. Sir Boros, roust the jailers and make certain the dwarf is still in his cell." She would not say his name. He would never have found the courage to lift a hand against father, she told herself, but she had to be certain. "As Your Grace commands." Blount surrendered the lantern to Sir Osmond. Circe was not displeased to see the back of him. Father should never have restored him to the white. The man had proved himself a craven. By the time they left Magor's Holdfast, the sky had turned a deep cobalt blue, though the stars still shone. "All but one," Circe thought. "The bright star of the west has fallen, and the nights will be darker now." She paused upon the drawbridge that spanned the dry moat, gazing down at the spikes below. "They would not dare lie to me about such a thing." "Who found him?" "One of his guards," said Sir Osmond. "Lum. He felt a call of nature and found his lordship in the privy." "No, that cannot be. That is not the way a lion dies." The queen felt strangely calm. She remembered the first time she had lost a tooth when she was just a little girl. It hadn't hurt, but the hole in her mouth felt so odd that she could not stop touching it with her tongue. "Now there is a hole in the world where father stood, and holes want filling." If Tywin Lannister was truly dead, no one was safe, least of all her son upon his throne. When the lion falls, the lesser beasts move in, the jackals and the vultures and the feral dogs. They would try to push her aside, as they always had. She would need to move quickly, as she had when Robert died. This might be the work of Stannis Baratheon, through some cat's paw. It could well be the prelude to another attack upon the city. She hoped it was. "Let him come. I will smash him just as father did, and this time he will die." Stannis did not frighten her no more than Mace Tyrell did. No one frightened her. She was a daughter of the Rock, a lion. "There will be no more talk of forcing me to wed again. Casterly Rock was hers now, and all the power of House Lannister. No one would ever disregard her again. Even when Tommen had no further need of a regent, the Lady of Casterly Rock would remain a power in the land." The rising sun had painted the tower tops a vivid red, but beneath the walls the night still huddled. The outer castle was so hushed that she could have believed all its people dead. They should be. It is not fitting for Tywin Lannister to die alone. Such a man deserves a retinue to attend his needs in hell. 4 spearmen in red cloaks and lion-crested helms were posted at the door of the Tower of the Hand. "No one is to enter or leave without my permission," she told them. The command came easily to her. My father had steel in his voice as well. Within the tower, the smoke from the torches irritated her eyes, but Circe did not weep. no more than her father would have. I am the only true son he ever had. Her heels scraped against the stone as she climbed, and she could still hear the moth fluttering wildly inside Sir Osmond's lantern. Die, the queen thought at it in irritation. Fly into the flame and be done with it. Two more red-cloaked guardsmen stood atop the steps. Red Leicester muttered a condolence as she passed. The queen's breath was coming fast and short, and she could feel her heart fluttering in her chest. The steps, she told herself. This cursed tower has too many steps. She had half a mind to tear it down. The hall was full of fools, speaking in whispers, as if Lord Tywin were asleep and they were afraid to wake him. Guards and servants alike shrank back before her, mouths flapping. She saw their pink gums and waggling tongues, but their words made no more sense than the buzzing of the moth. What are they doing here? How did they know? By rights, they should have called her first. She was the Queen Regent. Had they forgotten that? Before the Hand's bedchamber stood Sir Merrin Trant in his white armor and cloak. The visor of his helm was open, and the bags beneath his eyes made him look still, half asleep. Clear these people away, Circe told him. Is my father in the privy? They carried him back to his bed, my lady. Sir Merrin pushed the door open for her to enter. Morning lights slashed through the shutters to paint golden bars upon the rushes strewn across the floor of the bedchamber. Her uncle Kevin was on his knees beside the bed trying to pray, but he could scarcely get the words out. Guardsmen clustered near the hearth. The secret door that Sir Osmond had spoken of gaped open behind the ashes, no bigger than an oven. A man would need to crawl. But Tyrion is only half a man. The thought made her angry. No, the dwarf is locked in a black cell. This could not be his work. Stannis, she told herself. Stannis was behind it. He still has adherents in the city. Him or the Tyrells. There had always been talk of secret passages within the Red Keep. Maegor the Cruel was supposed to have killed the men who built the castle to keep the knowledge of them secret. How many other bedchambers have hidden doors? Circe had a sudden vision of the dwarf crawling out from behind a tapestry in Tommen's bedchamber with blade in hand. Tommen is well guarded, she told herself, but Lord Tywin had been well guarded too. For a moment she did not recognize the dead man. He had hair like her father, yes, but this was some other man, surely a smaller man and much older. His bedrobe was hiked up around his chest, leaving him naked below the waist. The quarrel had taken him in his groin between his navel and his manhood, and was sunk so deep that only the fletching showed. His pubic hair was stiff with dried blood. More was congealing in his navel. The smell of him made her wrinkle her nose. Take the quarrel out of him, she commanded. This is the king's hand. And my father, my lord father, should I scream and tear my hair? They said Catelyn Stark had clawed her own face to bloody ribbons when the Freys slew her precious Rob. Would you like that, father? She wanted to ask him, or would you want me to be strong? Did you weep for your own father? Her grandfather had died when she was only a year old, but she knew the story. Lord Titus had grown very fat, and his heart burst one day when he was climbing the steps to his mistress. Her father was off in King's Landing when it happened, serving as the mad king's hand. Lord Tywin was often away in King's Landing when she and Jaime were young. If he wept when they brought him word of his father's death, he did it where no one could see the tears. The queen could feel her nails digging into her palms. How could you leave him like this? My father was hand to three kings, as great a man as ever strode the Seven Kingdoms. The bells must ring for him, as they rang for Robert. He must be bathed and dressed as befits his stature, in ermine and cloth of gold and crimson silk. Where is Pycelle? Where is Pycelle? She turned to the guardsman. Puckins! Bring Grand Maester Pycelle. He must see to Lord Tywin.
"He's seen him, Your Grace," said Puckins. "He came and saw, and went, to summon the Silent Sisters."
They sent for me last. The realization made her almost too angry for words, and Pycelle runs off to send a message rather than soil his soft, wrinkled hands. The man is useless. "Find Maester Balabar," she commanded. "Find Maester Franken. Any of them?" Puckins and Shortier ran to obey. "Where is my brother?"
"Down the tunnel. There's a shaft with iron rungs set in the stone. Sir Jamie went to see how deep it goes."
"He has only one hand," she wanted to shout at them. "One of you should have gone. He has no business climbing ladders. The men who murdered Father might be down there waiting for him."
Her twin had always been too rash, and it would seem that even losing a hand had not taught him caution. She was about to command the guards to go down after him and bring him back when Puckins and Shortier returned with a grey-haired man between them.
"Your Grace," said Shortier, "this here claims he was a maester."
The man bowed low.
"How may I serve Your Grace?"
His face was vaguely familiar, though Circe could not place him.
"Old, but not so old as Pycelle. This one has some strength in him still."
He was tall, though slightly stooped, with crinkles around his bold blue eyes.
"His throat is naked."
"You wear no maester's chain."
"It was taken from me. My name is Kyburn, if it please Your Grace. I treated your brother's hand."
"His stump, you mean?" She remembered him now. He had come with Jamie from Harrenhal.
"I could not save Sir Jamie's hand, it is true. My arts saved his arm, however, mayhaps his very life. The citadel took my chain, but they could not take my knowledge."
"You may suffice," she decided. "If you fail me, you will lose more than a chain, I promise you." "Remove the quarrel from my father's belly and make him ready for the Silent Sisters."
"As my queen commands."
Kyburn went to the bedside, paused, looked back.
"And how shall I deal with the girl, Your Grace?"
"Girl?" Circe had overlooked the second body. She strode to the bed, flung aside the heap of bloody coverlets, and there she was, naked, cold, and pink, save for her face, which had turned as black as Joff's had at his wedding feast. A chain of linked golden hands was half buried in the flesh of her throat, twisted so tight that it had broken the skin. Circe hissed like an angry cat.
"What is she doing here?"
"We found her there, Your Grace," said Shortier. "It's the imp's whore." As if that explained why she was here.
"My lord father had no use for whores," she thought. "After our mother died, he never touched a woman."
She gave the guardsman a chilly look.
"This is not..."
"When Lord Tywin's father died, he returned to Casterly Rock to find a woman of this sort, bedecked in his lady mother's jewels, wearing one of her gowns. He stripped them off her and all else as well. For a fortnight she was paraded naked through the streets of Lannisport to confess to every man she met that she was a thief and a harlot. That was how Lord Tywin Lannister dealt with whores. He never... This woman was here for some other purpose, not for..."
"Perhaps his lordship was questioning the girl about her mistress," Kyburn suggested.
"Sansa Stark vanished the night the king was murdered, I have heard."
"That's so."
Circe seized on the suggestion eagerly. "He was questioning her, to be sure. There can be no doubt." She could see Tyrion leering, his mouth twisted into a monkey's grin beneath the ruin of his nose. "And what better way to question her than naked, with her legs well spread?" the dwarf whispered. "That's how I like to question her, too."
The queen turned away. "I will not look at her."
Suddenly it was too much even to be in the same room as the dead woman. She pushed past Kyburn, out into the hall. Sir Osmond had been joined by his brothers Osney and Osfrid.
"There is a dead woman in the Hand's bedchamber,"
Circe told the three kettle-blacks. "No one is ever to know that she was here."
"I'm a lady."
Sir Osney had faint scratches on his cheek where another of Tyrion's whores had clawed him.
And what shall we do with her? Feed her to your dogs. Keep her for a bedmate. What do I care? She was never here. I'll have the tongue of any man who dares to say she was. Do you understand me? Osney and Osfrid exchanged a look. Aye, Your Grace. She followed them back inside and watched as they bundled the girl up in her father's bloody blankets. Shay. Her name was Shay. They had last spoken the night before the dwarf's trial by combat, after that smiling Dornish snake offered to champion him. Shay had been asking about some jewels Tirion had given her and certain promises Circe might have made, a manse in the city and a knight to marry her. The queen made it plain that the whore would have nothing of her until she told them where Sansa Stark had gone. You were her maid. Do you expect me to believe that you knew nothing of her plans? She had said. Shay left in tears. Sir Osfrid slung the bundled corpse up over his shoulder. I want that chain, Circe said. See that you do not scratch the gold. Osfrid nodded and started toward the door. No, not through the yard. She gestured toward the secret passage. There's a shaft down to the dungeons. That way. As Sir Osfrid went down on one knee before the hearth, the light brightened within and the queen heard noises. Jaime emerged, bent over like an old woman, his boots kicking up puffs of soot from Lord Tywin's last fire. Get out of my way, he told the kettleblacks. Circe rushed toward him. Did you find them? Did you find the killers? How many were there? Surely there had been more than one. One man alone could not have killed her father. Her twin's face had a haggard look. The shaft goes down to a chamber where half a dozen tunnels meet. They're closed off by iron gates, chained and locked. I need to find keys. He glanced around the bedchamber. Whoever did this might still be lurking in the walls. It's a maze back there and dark. She imagined Tirion creeping between the walls like some monstrous rat. No, you're being silly. The dwarf is in his cell. Take hammers to the walls. Knock this tower down if you must. I want them found. Whoever did this, I want them killed. Jaime hugged her, his good hand pressing against the small of her back. He smelled of ash, but the morning sun was in his hair, giving it a golden glow. She wanted to draw his face to hers for a kiss. Later, she told herself, later he will come to me for comfort. We are his heirs, Jaime, she whispered. It will be up to us to finish his work. You must take father's place as hand. You see that now, surely. Tommen will need you. He pushed away from her and raised his arm, forcing his stump into her face. A hand without a hand? A bad jape, sister. Don't ask me to rule. Their uncle heard the rebuff. Qyburn as well, and the kettleblacks, wrestling their bundle through the ashes. Even the guardsmen heard, Puckins and Hoke, the horseleg and short ear. It will be all over the castle by nightfall. Circe felt the heat rising up her cheeks. Rule? I said naught of ruling. I shall rule until my son comes of age. I don't know who I pity more, her brother said. Tommen or the Seven Kingdoms. She slapped him. Jaime's arm rose to catch the blow, cat quick. But this cat had a crippled stump in place of her right hand. Her fingers left red marks on his cheek. The sound brought their uncle to his feet. Your father lies here dead. Have the decency to take your quarrel outside. Jaime inclined his head in apology. Forgive us, uncle. My sister is sick with grief. She forgets herself. She wanted to slap him again for that. I must have been mad to think he could be hand. She would sooner abolish the office. When had a hand ever brought her anything but grief? John Arryn put Robert Baratheon in her bed, and before he died he'd begun sniffing about her, and Jaime as well. Eddard Stark took up right where Arryn had left off. His meddling had forced her to rid herself of Robert sooner than she would have liked, before she could deal with his pestilential brothers. Tirion sold Myrcella to the Dornishmen, made one of her sons his hostage, and murdered the other.
and when Lord Tywin returned to King's Landing. The next hand will know his place, she promised herself.